as we said, that there are a number of suspicious deaths that have occurred in the UFO field, and this has gone on for 50 years. Mm-hmm. Edward's death is one. The death of a lesser-known UFO researcher named Morris Jessup is another from the late 1950s. The death of Edward Ruppelt, the Air Force captain we mentioned. Ruppelt died in 1960 at the age of 37 of a heart attack, just a year after he had revised his book. I mean, think about this. Ruppelt, in 1956, comes out of the Air Force and writes this book that is completely against the official Air Force line.
Yeah.
Air Force had been saying, there's nothing to this. It's really, we've got it all figured out. And Ruppelt writes this book, a very well-written book, in which he very meticulously says, well, absolutely not. There are a lot of cases that got us very much worked up. He said, in fact, if you'd walked into a Wright-Patterson Air Force base in summer of 52, you'd have thought we were being invaded. And he said it was all because of UFO reports. This is not what the Air Force wanted to hear.
Yeah.
Within a couple of years, the rumors were out that Ruppelt, who was then now working for Northrop, was under pressure to revise his book. And indeed, he did revise his book in 1959, came out in the early part of 1960. He added three chapters which totally debunked UFOs, absolutely opposite from everything that he had written in the original book. Said there's nothing to it. The whole tone of the book, in fact, of the last three chapters was just utterly sophomoric and childish, frankly.
Yeah.
Very much unlike the tone of his original book. And then the guy dropped dead. Just died.
Yeah, that's one of the strangest aspects of the whole thing.
And, you know, how do you prove that a heart attack is a murder? You cannot. But it is a fact that the ability existed even in 1960, even in 1955, to kill a person by means of chemicals that would induce a heart attack, and that if you were not autopsied right away, I mean within a couple of hours, no one would know. And this absolutely existed. I'm not saying Ruppelt definitely was murdered, but hell, it's very suspicious. On top of that, there were other signs, in particular, around 1960 that, in my opinion, showed signs of really heavy-handed national security pushing around of the UFO, of the people in the UFO field. This was the period just in early 62 when the former director of the CIA, a guy named Roscoe Hillencoder, another friend of Donald Kehoe's, Hillencoder was going to go before Congress in the spring of 1962, and Hillencoder was going to talk about the serious nature of the UFO phenomenon and how behind the scenes there was tremendous interest by the national security community. I mean, think about a former director of the CIA, Hillencoder ran CIA from 47 to 50, going in front of Congress and saying this.
Yeah.
It's just, it boggles the mind. And Kehoe had been planning this with Hillencoder. They'd been planning it with members of Congress. Everything was good to go. Suddenly, at the 11th hour, Hillencoder sends a message to Kehoe saying, sorry, but I think the Air Force is doing everything they could do. I think we should just get off their backs. By the way, I'm resigning from the board of directors of our organization, and I'm going to have nothing more to do with this. Thank you. Goodbye. And that's it.
Yeah.
Now, was Hillencoder pressured? Well, I think it's hard to say that, it's hard to deny that he was pressured. Are you going to be able to prove it? Of course not. Absolutely not.
Yeah,
there's suspicion, a lot of suspicious things.
Yeah, that's part one of the strangest aspects of that old guard that you speak of at the UFO research. Ruppelt and Hillencoder both ended up doing like 180s. And then,
and
not living too much longer afterwards.
Right. You know, when I think about, I didn't write this in the book. I think because I really hadn't had enough time to reflect on some of these issues. But it's my opinion when I look at the early period. You know, why would the secrecy have been so important? Well, I think a couple of reasons. To be honest with you, first of all, there's just the very likely, strong likelihood that the people who had the information on this may not have known enough about what these aliens were. I mean, if let's say you did recover technology at Roswell and probably at other places too.
Yeah.
So you're some super brilliant scientist, and your job 5 years is to study these materials that my office gives you, and you don't even know where they come from, probably, because everything's compartmented.
Yes.
I'm military, and I just say, hey, look, I can't tell you where it's from. I just want you to study it. And then suddenly, a few years later, you have this eureka moment where you think, holy smokes, well, we can make this really amazing high tensile fiber, or we can, you know, create superconductivity or lasers or whatever. We can improve our integrated circuits. You know what I mean? So not only do you have a great chip in the Cold War in terms of technology against the Russians, but you have a nice ground floor investment opportunity, to say the very least.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what's your motivation for wanting to give up this secret, basically? You know, you have no motivation for giving it up. Why? Are you going to share this with everyone else? I don't think so. It's just too valuable. And by the way, you know, in 1960, there wasn't this kind of desperate pressure on our energy infrastructure either that we're experiencing today.
Yeah.
In 1960, the world was swimming in cheap oil, and it looked to almost every oil analyst in the world that, hey, we're going to have this stuff, you know, for centuries and centuries, and we had more than enough time to come up with better means of energy in the future.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? This isn't 1960, and this is 2006, and everyone in the world now wants to drive cars, and you got China, and you got India, and you got everyone with their SUVs, and suddenly we're finding that some of these so-called fringe people are now being joined by mainstream petroleum geologists who are saying, hey, it does look like we might, after all, be peaking around now for all time in global petroleum production. Now, if that is true, I'm not saying it's definitely true, but there are some very responsible people who believe it is true, then we are facing, in our own civilization, the possibility of a massive, massive lockup and meltdown of our entire society. Because if you can't get gas in your car, then it's basically going to mean at some point you're not going to be able to get food in your belly.
Yeah.
Because our entire global agricultural system is also dependent on petroleum, and basically on cheap petroleum. Fertilizers are petroleum-based, tractors, of course, everything. I mean, you just basically can't feed 6.5 billion people in this world without cheap oil, unless you got something to replace it.
Yeah.
And indeed, it's quite possible, in my opinion, that the UFO phenomenon may have within it some kind of something to kind of help us out here.
Yeah.
And so we're in a much more stressful situation regarding all of that than we were 45 years ago. So the secret keepers back then, you know, could just say, hey, look, all in good time. All in good time. Right now, we're just going to ride out the petroleum wave, and everything will be fine, and people really don't need anything more than what we've got. But that is very likely not the case today, I think. So I think we're much more likely to be headed toward a real serious crisis that could very well involve the need for UFO disclosure. The problem, though, is, I mean, you start getting into this issue. I mean, could you imagine how difficult it would be for any president to go before the world and make such an announcement?
Yeah.
Now, he'd have to be a new president, it seems to me. A guy like Bush, I think, would have a hard time now. I mean, his credibility is low among many people already. I don't think he's got But could you imagine if he tried to announce it? He'd say, okay, well, everyone, it's come to my attention that UFOs apparently are real, and apparently they are alien in nature.
Yeah.
Well, you just can't leave it at that, because now you have a lot of other issues to raise. You know, it's like you can't be half pregnant. You can't half disclose. There's a whole question of abductions now.
Yeah.
Suddenly, all these people who've been claiming alien abduction, hey, guess what? The biggest hurdle that we all, I think, have to abductions is simply the reality of UFOs themselves. I mean, UFOs to some people are pretty far out. Abductions are even farther out. It's like you don't believe the one. Clearly you don't believe the other. But what if the one is true? And suddenly you acknowledge that there are other beings who are actually not just out there, but down here on the ground with us.
Yeah, yeah.
And some of these people who claim that they've been taken, hey, guess what? Maybe some of these people are telling the story accurately.
Yeah.
So that's a hot potato. Then there's other hot potatoes, possibly even worse.
Yeah.
You know, the whole issue of rumored underground bases, underground infrastructure. It is my personal contention that this actually would really, could very much, very possibly bring a downfall, I mean an actual downfall of the U.S. government with this kind of disclosure, and here's why. If you acknowledge UFOs are real, suddenly people like myself and all these other researchers out there are going to have a bit more credibility, for one. And a lot of these people are talking about reverse engineered technology, massive infrastructure that's completely secret. Okay, well, if that's true, then on whose money are you building this infrastructure? Is it on tax dollars? Well, actually, I think that it's connected at least as much to narcotics trafficking proceeds.
Yeah.
Securities fraud, that is stock market fraud, is anything else.
Yeah.
When you need secret stores of money, here, it's nice to have classified tax dollars, but it's even more convenient to have unvouchered money altogether.
Yeah.
And the amount of money in these other areas is immense. I was just going through this morning, for the umpteenth time, a news story from 2001 that had to do with Donald Rumsfeld. Now, this is very important. Everyone should know about this. It will be in my book. In July of 2001, Rumsfeld was in front of Congress talking about the Pentagon's budget and problems associated with the budget and missing money from the Pentagon.
Yeah.
And specifically, what Rumsfeld said, and I am not making this up, you can look it up. He said, in fact, I'll give you the exact quote, I think I've got it right here, but he says, our accountants tell us, here we go. According to some estimates, we cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
Wow.
$2.3 trillion. When you think about the Pentagon fiscal year budget for 2001, it was $310 billion, about one-eighth the amount.
Yeah.
So you've got eight times this figure that's missing. Where is it?
Yeah.
I mean, the mind reels at such a thought. How long did it take to get to 2.3 trillion? That's one question I had. No one asked that. Where did the money come from? Where did it go? Well, I assume a lot of it went into private bank accounts, but 2.3 trillion?
Yeah.
How is this even possible? So what I think happened is that some significant portion of this money probably went into secret infrastructure. I think the rumors of underground bases are very likely based on fact, at least in some significant cases. And so you've got a very significant infrastructure that does not officially exist, but that does exist. And so my point simply is with UFO disclosure, this kind of information is much more likely to come out, and if and when it comes out, people are going to realize that they've been had. And so the real question will be, are we going to then come to a point of, let's say, people having revolution in the streets, or an iron-fisted kind of open totalitarianism? And I don't really know. I mean, yeah. I don't think any of us knows the answer to that one. But.
And now, talking a little bit about the schizophrenic nature of the Air Force, where they sort of publicly, nonchalantly acted like UFOs weren't a big deal, but then GNAP 146 is probably one of the more infamous military orders in the UFO field, and that pretty much shut down any chance of people from the from the Air Force going out and telling the press, telling any researchers, or telling anybody about their UFO sightings.
Absolutely. And in fact, my all appearances JNAP is still in force today. It's gone through a number of, I went through this issue with fellow UFO researcher John Greenwald, who's known for his website, The Black Vault. And we both believe JNAP is still in effect. There's no indication that it isn't in effect. There have been revisions. There was another revision in 1977. Still, everything's just the same as before. There was a reference to it in a 1996, I believe, document by the Air Force. So it apparently is still good. But you're right about schizophrenic, because the UFO nature has forced a kind of schizophrenia on our entire society. And in terms of the Air Force and other military branches, let's talk about the Air Force. They've been saying for years, well, no, we've got it under control. Yeah, there are some sightings we can't explain, but there's no evidence that they're either alien or unexplained technology, etc. Nothing to worry about, go back to sleep. On the other hand, we have time and again excellent evidence to show that the Air Force has gotten very worked up over this. In the case of JNAP 146, this is an order, stands for Joint Army Navy Air Force publication, that originally came out in the mid-1950s, early 50s, that was a series of regulations over how to report, like if you were in the military, how you would report certain kinds of events. And JNAP 146 includes UFOs, and in fact it explicitly states unidentified flying objects, and in fact explicitly differentiates that from other kinds of things that skeptics would call UFOs, like foreign aircraft or meteors, or you know what I mean? So that UFOs are separate from all of those other categories.
Yeah.
In other words, real UFOs are treated as a category in JNAP 146, which is kind of interesting. To this day, that is the case. So, and what that meant is if you, according to JNAP 146, if you were to see a UFO, you had to report it along certain channels, military channels, in certain manner. And, of course, you're not allowed to disseminate information about this without authorization. And so that was essentially a gag order. Right away, JNAP began to apply to civilian commercial pilots. And so, in fact, in the mid-50s, this became an issue. There was a petition that was signed by something like 400, I believe, commercial airline pilots against this gag order. And that failed. That petition failed in the mid-50s, though. So it did get some traction for a little while, and there was some resistance to it, but, of course, it didn't go anywhere. To this day, I know pilots who, you know, they've seen UFOs. I've spoken to quite a few of them, and this goes on. It goes on this year. It's been going on nonstop for year after year after year. These guys will see things in the sky, and frequently they don't report it, because if you report UFOs, it really can damage your career. I've been doing this many times. And in fact, we know that this has happened. It was a famous case in 1986 of a Japanese pilot who was going from Alaska to Japan.
Yep.
And over the ocean, I mean, for about a half hour, noticed this enormous object. I mean, drew a explicit picture of it. This object was tracked on radar. The Federal Aviation Administration representatives discussed it. They said, yes, it happened. And this pilot was basically pushed to a desk job for a long time as a result of that sighting.
Yeah.
It can be bad for your career.
Yeah. Okay, now let's talk a little bit about NICAP. They're like the first UFO supergroup, almost.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. NICAP was, it stands for National Investigative Committee on Aerial Phenomena.
Yeah.
Actually, NICAP was originally founded in 1956 by a really interesting guy named Thomas Townsend Brown.
Yeah.
Brown himself is a legendary man, did a lot of brilliant, let's say, work on kind of on anti-gravity and electrogravitics.
Yes.
The original draft of my book didn't have a lot on Brown, and the common revised version of my book does have quite a bit more on Brown, fortunately. But Brown was interested in UFOs and started NICAP in the late 56, kind of as a scientist would start it, you know, wanting to just sort of gather information on this, at least that's what it seems like. And what happened was Donald Kehoe, who was also known in the UFO field and had written written at that point two books on the topic and was known in the Navy and in the intelligence community. Kehoe sort of took over the group in a meeting in January, I think 1957, and they kind of ousted Brown. What Kehoe wanted was a political approach to the UFO problem, and that was his dedication for the next decade or a little bit more, which was to try to get the matter of UFOs in front of Congress. In other words, what NICAP tried to do was to take the high road. That is, they worked under the assumption that the United States government was what every kid grows up believing it's supposed to be, which is a government where you elect your assemblyman, you elect your congressman, and they fight for you in Congress, and that's how the whole system works with checks and balances and all that stuff.
Yeah.
All that stuff that we now know doesn't work at all. But in the 50s, this was the assumption that, I mean, they weren't so pie-in-the-sky idealistic as to realize that there weren't problems. I mean, obviously they did. They knew that there was secrecy, and they knew that the system wasn't working right. But they believed in the system. I think that's fair to say. And so year after year after year, Kehoe and other NICAP leaders, including a couple of people who are still alive, like Richard Hall, worked and talked with members of Congress to try to get open hearings on UFOs. And there were a number of years in the late 50s and early 60s when it looked like they just might succeed. I mentioned the Hillenkoetter episode of 1962 when Hillenkoetter was about to do this, and this was being sponsored by NICAP. Well, there were other instances as well prior to that. But every time it also seemed like right at the last minute, some congressman would come up to Kehoe and say, hey, look, sorry, it's not going to happen this year. We can't get enough votes to make it happen. Let's go for the next session, and we think it'll go better that time. And this happened. It was almost like an annual thing, like the Boston Red Sox just not making it for a World Series. And so, that was a story year in, year out. Now, in that time, NICAP also did some very, very excellent work in terms of just organizing and collating UFO data. And really, NICAP was the first major competitor to the United States Air Force publicly as an authority of UFOs.
Yeah.
And they were able to pull it off because, A, they had really good people.
Yeah.
B, a lot of those people had military backgrounds, and we were not talking like guys like me, you know, so-called liberal, radical, pinko, commie, whatever, even though I'm actually none of any of those things. But the guys on NICAP were, they were retired admirals and other officers in all branches of the military. I mean, these are very respected individuals.
Yeah.
And so you couldn't really impugn their patriotism and all that good stuff. So NICAP really was able, they had the goods, and they were a true competitor and threat to the Air Force's stature on this in the public relations field. And frankly, I mean, NICAP had no money to work with. Everything was bare bones. Kehoe was constantly trying to raise money. The organization always seemed like it was on the brink of bankruptcy. You know, despite all of that, I mean, NICAP made a really fantastic show of it. But of course, they were not able to do it either. And you know, when you don't have access to the institutional levers of power that the Air Force had, it's kind of difficult. They tried to just before the Colorado Committee got going in the late 60s. There was going to be this congressional hearing on UFOs in 1966, and it did take place, but it was just massively disappointing. They had people like Carl Sagan being consulted, and no one in NICAP was
invited
to speak. Yeah. And they were invited to attend but not speak. And so it was a real disappointment, the big congressional hearing that they pushed for a decade. They weren't even invited to speak.
Yeah.
So.
And now, there's a lot of talk that they were sort of like infiltrated by the CIA. Some people think it's never been really outright like proven that that was the goal, but
well,
it certainly seems that that
not proven,
happened.
But very suspicious.
Yeah.
And this was information that came out really as the organization was in its death throes in the 1970s, after Kehoe was really not active in it. Yes, that's right. There are a number of things you really have to wonder about. First of all, before we get into the whole situation with NICAP, people, this is really not radical anymore, but let's, maybe it is for some people. It is very well understood now that the CIA had been involved in infiltrating a lot of organizations in the 1950s and 60s, and absolutely U.S. major media, was very much in bed with the CIA.
Yeah.
All these were things that people, the guy in the street in the 1950s and 60s really did not suspect, and I think would have been very angry about had they known at the time that this was happening.
Yes.
If CIA's got 400 paid informants and journalists within mainstream U.S. news media, hell, that's important to know, and we didn't know about that until the mid-1970s. They also made it a point to have a lot of influence in cultural issues in the 1960s. And so what they would typically do, famously there's an organization called the Congress of Cultural Freedom. This has been very well documented, that the CIA infiltrated this and controlled it without even most of the members realizing. All you do is you place a couple of guys in key positions. The best position is the number two spot in the organization. A friend of mine calls that the spook spot, because it's not particularly visible, but it's very influential, and this is a guy who theoretically would report back to CIA and kind of keep tabs on everyone. And also, if need be, push the organization into directions that wouldn't necessarily be good for that organization, if so decided. So regarding NICAP was an organization that came on as a major threat to the established status quo of UFO secrecy. We all know this. We know in the 1953 Robertson panel report before the origin of NICAP, but that one of the directives, or recommendations I should say, was to monitor the existing UFO groups. This was explicitly stated. Keep an eye on them. We also know that a number of the people who came on board with NICAP in the late 50s and early 60s were, in fact, CIA members. Not all of them were known to be CIA.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the most prominent was a guy named Colonel Joseph Bryan, who became ingratiated with Kehoe and in 1969 ousted Kehoe from the board of directors. Bryant, turns out, had founded the CIA Psychological Warfare Unit, and was very, very upper-level CIA man.
Yeah.
And all those years had been involved in NICAP. Now, that's true, and then there are other CIA connections with NICAP, too, that maybe we don't need to go into the detail here, but you can read my book and read about it. But the point is that, what was the direction that they may have pushed? Well, Kehoe, I think, came to believe that, his focus for years and years and years, he had focused on the Air Force as the kind of root of secrecy. But it does appear that toward the later 60s, Kehoe started to look at the CIA as possibly the power behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Unfortunately for Kehoe, he was also at that time starting to get a little older, was really not as involved physically in managing the organization and kind of was becoming, I think, a little more of a figurehead than he had been in the years past. So there's also close CIA connections, in my opinion, with Richard Hall. Richard Hall was Kehoe's number two man for years at NICAP. And I don't mind saying this, by the way, because Hall didn't like my book. So, at least the good people at the International UFO Reporter allowed me to rebut Keogh's Hall's review.
That's good.
A couple of years ago. Anyway, Hall, back in the mid-60s, first of all, he came to NICAP out of Air Force Intelligence. Keogh wrote about this. And we know was in communication covertly with CIA in 1965, sending them NICAP reports. Hall came out with that, and he, you know, explained it as nothing devious or anything like that. That may not have been. But it is true that a lot of these people in NICAP were very, very chummy with CIA and other intelligence. And maybe it doesn't mean anything. Maybe you could argue it's just those groups of people that become interested in UFOs that get into the field. Conversely, you can easily argue that, you know, you start working for the CIA. Maybe you don't stop working for the CIA.
Yeah.
And you know, you do some work for them from time to time. I don't know. I mean, I don't pretend. Again, getting proven information on a lot of these people is very difficult to
do. Yeah. The other group that sort of emerged at this time was APRO. They were sort of like a friendly rival of NICAP, but they had a different point of view. They weren't about going after the Air Force. They were more research-oriented.
That's right. APRO, Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, was founded by a married couple named James and Coral Lorenzen. And you know, APRO was a really impressive organization. They were based out west. They weren't the political Eastern Washington-based NICAP. And friendly rivalry, and at times an unfriendly rivalry. There was sometimes, as years went on, there was some harsh words exchanged from time to time. But it's true. I mean, the Lorenzens felt, they say, hey, look, you know, NICAP, you're just spinning your wheels with all this political disclosure. It wasn't called disclosure then, but the same, you know, trying to force this issue open. They said, look, just try to be scientific and just study the phenomenon and be done with it. And this is what APRO tried to do. And by and large, I think they were very successful in doing that. Again, like NICAP on a bare bones, like NICAP, a bare bones budget.
Yeah.
You know, there's no money in the UFO field. Anyone listening who thinks they want to write a book and make money on this, I would say, well, you know, go for it, write your book, but don't expect you're going to make money on this. And there's very little funding available. I mean, the only money that's available might be from some rich sugar daddy if you can find them.
Yeah.
Good luck, and then let me know, please. There isn't, I mean, you think about, like, the U.S. federal budget in, the last one I checked was fiscal year 2006, was $2.5 trillion. Right, the entire budget. As far as I can tell, none of it was allocated for what you could call UFO research. And none of it officially. I mean, I assume that there's classified money there. But the point is, if you want to research this, you're not going to get money from the U.S. government. It just is not going to happen. And so UFO organizations, again and again, and this is the case now of MUFON for all these years, which has succeeded APRO and NICAP, basically, they have no money. They have no money. And by the way, there's constant rumors about MUFON's infiltration as well by government, you know, intelligence operatives. There's certainly, just like with NICAP, there's a very large number of senior MUFON people who have definite ties to the world of intelligence. And again, you could just make the same argument.
Yeah.
In the case of MUFON, like APRO, MUFON overall has been kind of non-political, sort of in between NICAP and APRO.
Yeah, yeah.
MUFON, you know, went through brief periods where they seemed to get kind of politically energized, and then other periods where they were, like, absolutely non-political and promoted what they call scientific ufology.
Yeah.
Kind of like the other major organization, at least in the 70s and 80s, CUFOS, the Center for UFO Studies. Same thing, founded by J. Allen Hynek. Scientific ufology. And so some people have argued And I, so again, all you can say at this point is conjecture that this is the case. But I've argued that MUFON's direction was that MUFON was really just like a vacuum cleaner of UFO reports.
Yeah.
To collect these things up and then forward them to the relevant authorities in the intelligence community, allowed to exist as long as it didn't rock the boat too much.
Yeah, yeah.
And that could well be the case, frankly. I mean, there's no question, none, that groups like MUFON and CUFOS have been consistently monitored by the U.S. intelligence community. I have it on very good inside authority myself. That this, so like, in other words, that UFO conferences are frequently, I mean, the important conferences are attended by members of the intelligence community whose job it is to keep tabs on the UFO people, as one person said to me, the UFO people. So, we're an object of monitoring by a portion of the intelligence community.
And it's sort of like MUFON sort of grew out of the ashes, really, of NICAP and APRO, and like they followed.
Yeah, well,
you know, but the same when they were sort of dying out.
That's right. They actually, for a period of time, all three coexisted.
Yeah.
But yeah, MUFON was founded by Walter Andres, who had been prominent in APRO.
Oh, okay.
And was. Not too happy, I guess, about the leadership of the Lorenzans. So Lorenzans, I never knew these people, but the impression that I get from reading about them was that they didn't really have what you'd call an inclusive leadership style. And so they kind of kept things to themselves. They didn't really train the next generation of leaders. And so I sense that there was some frustration among people in the organization. So Andres bolted in 1969, forming what was then called the Midwest UFO Network, and that became the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON. And he took a lot of APRO members with him, and the Lorenzans were furious. I mean, they just never forgave Walter Andres for that. APRO did keep along for a number of years, right up into the 1980s when the Lorenzans just became sick, old, and then died. And then really no one was there to replace them. When they died, that was the end of APRO.
And one of the things I ask a lot of people about, because I was at the X conference last year and I saw Walt Andres, and he gave a really great presentation on all the different groups. And one thing that really sparked my interest, and you probably heard more about it than I have, is these infamous missing APRO files, how they're like locked down now, and no one can get to them.
Well, yeah, what happened when... This has been known for some time, but no one can get to these damn files.
Yeah.
The Lorenzans died in 86, and then in 88, I think. I forget who died. Jim died first. I can't remember which died first.
Yeah.
By the late 1980s, they both died, and I remember asking around about this too. You know, who's got, because the Lorenzans, you think they had 35 years of files. That's my other phone. I'm just ignoring that. They had all these files and files and files. I mean, yeah, they wrote a bunch of books, but a lot of this stuff that they'd collected, of course, never made it into the books.
Yeah.
And so where is it, and what did they collect? I mean, when you think about it.
Oh, yeah.
It was gobbled up by some guy who just put them, apparently, in a garage. They were locked away. The only thing that I can learn about this guy is that he's very unfriendly and won't let anyone use the files.
Yeah.
And so they are gone. Gone. I mean, it's really a horrible, it's a tragedy that these files, I mean, they could be destroyed for all we know. Who knows what happened to them?
Yeah, it's really bizarre.
Yeah, it is. You get a lot of that in this field.
I know. One of the sections in the book that really made me think was thoughts on Hynek. And you sort of mentioned that he, in today's ufology, he's been romanticized, really. But it's important to remember that as ufology was growing, he was sort of looked at as a debunker at first, and we can't necessarily, put up the bronze plaque of him yet.
Yeah, that's right. I caught some grief over this, actually, more than... when I think about it, probably more than any other single section of my book was what I said about Alan Hynek.
Yeah.
And it wasn't all hostile, but even people who liked my book, a few of the people who knew Hynek were uncomfortable with what I wrote. And here's my take on Alan Hynek. He seems like he was a very nice man. And so for me to write what I did probably was only possible because I never knew the man personally.
Yeah.
Because had I met him, I probably wouldn't want to say anything bad about him. But the fact of the matter is this. Alan Hynek was on board with the Air Force through the 1940s and 50s and 60s as a consultant to Project Blue Book. All through that period, right up until the mid-60s, Hynek was a loyal scientist who could be relied on to give the Air Force explanations that they wanted, you know, of cases that they would send him. He was a junior member participant in the Robertson panel. I mean, very junior, but he was there. He signed on to everything and apparently was quite enthusiastic, according to the records that we have of that. And then the other thing that I learned was that Hynek, this is according to the memoirs of Jacques Vallée, in his very valuable diary he published known as Forbidden Science, and Hynek had been, for 5 years, sort of under the tutelage of arch UFO debunker Donald Menzel.
Oh, really?
At Harvard University. They worked, Menzel was the Harvard Astronomy Department, and from the late 50s into the early 60s, Hynek worked there. He had a 5-year stint over there, where he was a junior member of that astronomy department, and in which he and Menzel apparently were on very friendly terms. Now, again, that doesn't necessarily mean a heck of a lot, but it has to make you wonder when these two are, you know, I mean, that the current on the top and the currents below aren't moving in the same directions, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
Hynek really didn't come around to promoting UFO reality until he had really stepped in it big time in the public relations game in 1966 when he issued his famous statement about Michigan swamp gas.
Yes.
I mean, this is during when there were all of these sightings and it was making the news. And Hynek was rushed out by the Air Force to explain it. And he talked about swamp gas rising and interacting and creating this lighting effect. And, I mean, the press was just like, what? That made no sense at all. I mean, it really was a little bit. And years later, Hynek said, that was really kind of a rather not my best moment. But the thing was, what happened was Hynek just suddenly, looked like an idiot. And the whole institutional structure of the Air Force looked really, really bad. My feeling, and all I can do here is guess, but that Hynek, probably looked at his life at that point, and he said, it's 1966, and in 1966, no one knew how this whole UFO thing was going to turn out. It looked like it just might result in some kind of open admission at this point. So here's Hynek, and he's thinking, what pony have I hitched myself to here? I look like a fool, and you know what? In fact, there is very likely, something going on here. It was also at that time that another scientist enters the mix, and this is the great James McDonald. McDonald was an atmospheric physicist, very prominent scholar in his field, and McDonald got interested in UFOs. He had seen a UFO in the 50s, very quietly sort of followed along, and then in the mid-60s really started investigating a bunch of old cases, making ways. He got access, he was able to get access to some of the Blue Book files, saw the Robertson panel report, which he wasn't supposed to see, and he did see it. So mad, he walked into Hynek's office and famously slammed his fist down on the table and basically said, what the hell have you been doing all these years?
Yeah.
And I think that shook Alan Hynek up. So Hynek had his own conversion experience, and let's not take that away from him, but the point is that is this a sign of his greatness because he finally came around, or or something else. UFO researchers, I mean, we're just so desperate to latch on to any person of any semblance of prestige in the field. With a guy like Hynek, he was an established professor and so on, and so I think the tendency for people in the UFO field is to say, all is forgiven now that you're one of us,
yeah.
Whereas we love you. Okay, fine. But Hynek, even after the closing of Blue Book, appears to have maintained a relationship with the U.S. military.
Mm-hmm.
There were various statements he made in which he indicated he was still getting paid as a consultant on various matters. And most recently, in a book published by a writer, Greg Bishop, who's Gregory Bishop's a friend of William Moore, the infamous William Moore. Bishop wrote just a year ago that Hynek was even involved in promoting false information to Paul Benowitz. Paul Benowitz was a scientist who was studying possible UFOs out in the southwestern New Mexico. And that Hynek, according to what Bishop wrote, actually gave Benowitz a computer that had been wired by the intelligence community so that they would be able to monitor him. In 1981, I think this was.
Wow.
Now, I've asked a couple of people, is this true? No one knows. I asked Jacques Vallée if he thought it might be true. Vallée never wrote the forward to my book, but he didn't get back to me on that one. So, I don't know. But there is reason to think Hynek had a long-standing relationship with the U.S. intelligence community. And all I would say is, in a case like that, you just have to be wary of who you're dealing with. And that goes for people today. I mean, there are people who are in the UFO field that openly have had a background in U.S. intelligence. And maybe they're straight shooting. But even my attitude is anyone, I mean this, anyone who's comes into this field out of the intelligence community, if they don't state it up front, you know, we should be very suspicious of these people and what their motivations are. And if you find out years after the fact, that's just not good. And there are a number of such people in this field who have such backgrounds.
That does it for this week's edition of Been All of America Audio. Big thanks to Richard Dolan for coming on the show. His website is www.keyholepublishing.com, KEYHOLEpublishing.com. The book, of course, is UFOs and the National Security State, Chronology of a Cover-Up, 1941 to 1973. You can get the book pretty much anywhere. It's so well-established. It's one of the biggest books in the UFO field, so you shouldn't have a hard time finding it. Go to Amazon, go to Barnes & Noble, go to his website. You'll be able to pick it up. Grab it, read it. You're going to love it, I'm sure. Big thanks to Leslie, Chiron, and R. Lee of BeenAllOfAmerica.com for your help and support with the audio series. I want to give a big, super huge thanks and kudos to BeenAllOfAmerica.com's Leslie, who will be penning her one-year anniversary column at BeenAllOfAmerica.com this coming Tuesday. Leslie, you have become an amazing writer, an amazing contributor, and someone who's really helped keep the BeenAllOfAmerica.com ship running. You've also become a great friend of mine. Thanks for being a part of the team. Thanks for helping us out so much. Thanks for your support. Hopefully we'll be celebrating many more years of working together as our adventures take us further and further into the strange world of esoterica. Who knows where this amazing journey is going to end up, but hopefully we'll all be watching it together, and it's going to be a blast to see it unfold. Also, I want to give a plug to Leslie's blog, where she is running a special contest in conjunction with the Sci-Fi Channel and Ghost Hunters, the TV series. I mean, this is big time, folks. Let me give you the information about it. Have you ever captured what may be an unearthly spirit on a photo? The Debris Field, Sci-Fi Channel, and Ghost Hunters bring you the Ghost Photo Contest. To enter, you must have a photo of a ghost, or what could be a ghost, and reside in the U.S. The contest will run from April 28, 2006 through May 28, 2006. At the end of the contest, everyone will be allowed to vote on their three favorite photos to decide the winners. Voting will be from May 29, 2006 to June 6, 2006. Photos will be posted at thedebrisfield.blogspot.com. And let me spell that out for you. thedebrisfield.blogspot.com. And ghostphotocontest.blogspot.com. That's pretty simple. Ghostphotocontest.blogspot.com. I don't think I need to spell that for you. I think you can figure that one out. And you can find out more information about how to enter the contest at that website there, ghostphotocontest.blogspot.com. The prizes, I know you want to hear about the prizes, and I do too. Let's hear what they are. First place, you'll receive a Ghost Hunters Season 1 DVD collection and Ghost Hunters Keyring. Second place will receive a Sci-Fi Channel T-shirt and Ghost Hunters Keyring. And third place will receive the Sci-Fi Channel T-shirt. Here is, again, the web address for more information on the contest, how to enter, the prizes, and some of the pictures that have already been sent in. You can find them. They're already up there at ghostphotocontest.blogspot.com. So there you go. That's a super huge contest with real prizes, and check that out if you can. Next week, Richard Dolan, part 2 of 2. We're going to be talking about more classic ufology. We're going to be talking about modern-day ufology. We're going to be talking about the world at large and geopolitics a little bit. So you're going to get just a whole host of stuff. That will be next week, May 6th, 2006, 566 at binallofamerica.com, binallofamerica.com. That does it, folks. Until you hear from me next week, this is Tim Binall, signing off.